Thanks, Brother James, and good evening, my dearly loved brethren and sisters, and our dear young people. Well, we left Jacob at Bethel in our last study, weary and afraid as he was when he arrived, but as he had found the place he was looking for there as he lay down that night, he was given an amazing vision and heard the assurance from the heavenly messenger that God would always be with him. You know, when Jacob came to think about what that really meant, we know he was awed by the circumstances of that night and by the vision that he'd seen. But more than that, he was fearful because of what he'd seen, because he realized just how close God actually was. You know, brothers and sisters, that is a real turning point in people's lives, and in our life it is too, when we really understand just how close God is to every one of us. You know what Jacob said? He said, even in this place is the house of God. Even this place, right where he was. And that's exactly what God was trying to teach him. That in this place, no matter where you are, Jacob, you could be out in the field, on the top of a mountain, anywhere you like, and in this place, God was there. He was in the house of God wherever he was, and God was never going to take his eyes off the superintendence of his life and guiding him along the way. And Jacob's reaction to that was really noteworthy, because he never ever wanted to forget that experience and the impact that it made upon him that particular night. And there's the evidence of him being a godly and earnest man, because he not only set up a memorial stone to recognize that he never wanted to forget that, but he vowed that since God had done this for him, since God had revealed himself and given him this great promise, then he was going to be his God. And all his days he wanted to just put his trust and learn to come to grips with this God of Abraham, his father, and of Isaac, his father. You know, it's the spirit of a very great man. Despite that one day of weakness that we saw early that had precipitated this event. But you know, brothers and sisters, this is really an interesting record. The way the Bible is written is just fascinating. Because Jacob, just responding the way he did to that event that night, we then read in verse 1 of chapter 29 at an unfortunate chapter break in here, but verse 1 says, "Then Jacob went on his journey and came into the land of the people of the east." Now that's another 1,300 kilometres from there, but look what the margin says. "Then Jacob lift up his feet and came into the land," as if he was just there. There's just something amazing. He stumbled wearily in fear of Isaac following him as he came to that place that night as a Syrian ready to perish, as Moses was to later call him. But now, after that vision, he's enlivened and energized. He lifts up his feet and in no time is in Syria. Right where he finds the family that he's looking for, just like that. Quite amazing. Now, there's a very, very powerful lesson there, brothers and sisters, just in passing. Because life changes when we can view it by faith. You know, if we could really see, brothers and sisters, as he did that night, that the angels were there alongside us, that the Yahweh angel was standing there, that all around us on this great staircase to heaven, the angels are effortlessly going backwards and forwards between heaven and earth on our behalf. If only we could see that, brothers and sisters, what need is there to drag our feet? Why wouldn't we lift our feet up and want to just get on with life and the purpose that God had called us for? And that's what he's about. That's what we see this man doing. That vision had affected him to such a degree that despite all the things that were around him and hanging over his head and how depressed he must have felt by the circumstances that happened back in his own house, now faith just lifts up over the top of all of that and the Spirit soars across all the difficulties in life. With us, it's no different. But the interesting thing is that despite his energy and despite his faith and his trust in that vision that night, there were yet many circumstances that he didn't know about at this stage, many experiences to cross his path that were to test this energized spirit that had come about because of faith. And therefore, year after year after year, Jacob's lot was to be trouble and strife and anxiety and weariness to prepare him for glory. But it wasn't just that all that crowded in on him. God had prepared him by giving him that vision before he went in. And he'd taken him into Syria, as Hosea says, so that he, according to his ways, might be repaid. God was going to bring him. He'd given that him that assurance that he would bring him back to the land that where his fathers were. But not until he had finished the work that he had to accomplish with him, his intended work. And there, for a period of probation, he goes away that God might help him see the Syrian within that he was unable to deal with effectively until this point. You know, sometimes God does that in our lives, brethren and sisters. And Jacob is an interesting example of where the trials of life come about sometimes because of our own weakness, because of some particular flaw of character that we actually have. And God just uses it in order to perfect us. And here we find Jacob fleeing because of his own deception of his father. And he falls into the hands of a master deceiver, a master schemer that made him pale into insignificance in terms of his scheming. But he learned in that man and in that house to hate the very characteristic that he once had had. And to hate the hands of Esau, as they were called, but now became the hands of the flesh in the presence of Laban. Well, we find that he gets over here to the land of Syria, and very quickly he finds the family that he's looking for under the providence of God. But here's a timeline of Jacob's life. And it suggests here that he was in Syria for a period of about 40 years. Now, we're not going to spend a lot of time on this tonight, and there is a handout here if you'd like, and some of these charts are actually on there, as well as another parallel chart showing the life of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and how they interact and how they link. There are a number of points of connection that we know of in the record where you can make the connections, but if you just have a look at this for a moment, where did it go? It's over this side. We know that a few things, like when Jacob moved down to Egypt later in his life, we know that he was 130 years of age. The record tells us that. And we know that Joseph was approximately this age, approximately 39 at the time. He was about 30 when he came into power, Genesis 41 tells us. There were 7 years of seven good years, and it was sometime soon into the famine years, so approximately 9 years altogether from when he came to be ruler over Egypt. So we're putting him at about 39. It would be very close to his age at the time. So there's a link point here between the age of Jacob and the age of Joseph. And if Joseph is 39 at that point, we can go back to find the time Joseph was born. And it is that point in the record when we're told that Jacob finally made his decision to leave Syria and go back. Now, he didn't leave at that moment, but he had made his decision on the birth of Joseph to go back to the land. So there's a number of points here that we can actually link together. He then served for 6 years for cattle. So it makes Jacob here 91, and then for 6 years he's 97 at the time that he leaves Haran to return to his father's house. Now, I've suggested that he might have been here for 40 years, and there is some dispute about this. The record is not absolutely clear. I believe that it probably was 40 years. It actually fits the whole type of Joseph's life if it was, but that's not the definitive point in the circumstance. There are really two schools of thought, that Jacob was 20 years or 40 years in Syria. Might I say that it really, in the end, doesn't matter how long he was there, though there are some difficulties, I believe, with the 20-year period. And we'll just have a look at a couple of verses here in Genesis 31 in a moment. But the two ideas are this. We have 7 years serving for Rachel. Sorry, that's incorrect in here, isn't it? One's for Leah and Rachel. Right, for Rachel, and then an extra to actually get Rachel. He's really deceived at this point. So it's 14 years for his wives, which is down here, and 6 years for cattle. Those periods are definitely mentioned. And if you put that together, it's 20 years. And the record of Genesis does mention a period of 20 years. But it appears that there may well be another period of 20 years in which he was not actually specifically serving for anything particular, but he was there as a relative and friend in the house, still working on behalf of Laban, but not under Laban's duress, though Laban was always a hard taskmaster. Now, if we have a look at chapter 31... and at verse 38, one of the difficulties that we actually have, if it was simply the 7 years, 7 years plus 6 years, we know this, that at the start of the 6 years of his serving for cattle, Joseph was born at that point. Now, one of the difficulties that there is, that in this seven-year period then, from the time he was given Leah and then Rachel, Leah was to give birth to six sons plus a daughter, and the record tells us that Leah was barren for a period. Now, whenever we read about barrenness in the lives of the patriarchs, it's extended periods. It's not just a year or two of not having any children. It's generally an extended period. Now, we don't know how long that period was, but if you do a little bit of the sums, that's going to be a very difficult situation to achieve in 7 years. The birth of six sons plus a daughter, you've got seven children plus a period of barrenness, all crunched into that period. Now, that's not counting the other sons that were born to the handmaids. And in that period also, there's an extended period of barrenness, which caused a great deal of angst in that family with Rachel. During that period, there's two other sons born and the birth of Joseph, which presumably was right at the end of this period. So there appears on the surface to be some difficulty in just really fitting that. Is that what it's actually saying? Well, come to Genesis 31 and verse 38. And here he says, Jacob speaking to Laban at the end, says, "This 20 years have I been with thee. Thy ewes and thy she-goats have not cast their young, and the rams of thy flock have I not eaten," and so on. And he goes on to say, keep reading down, verse 40, "Thus I was in the day that drought consumed me, and the frost by night, and my sleep departed from mine eyes. Thus have I been 20 years in thine house. I served thee 14 years for thy two daughters and 6 years for thy cattle, and thou hast changed my wages 10 times. Now, This is really what it appears it's saying, because the Hebrew construction of those two verses, verse 38 and verse 41, both of which mention a period of 20 years, have the sense of this period and that, as if distinguishing between two periods. And now I've read that in Hebrew scholars actually making mention of that, and I also then raised it at some stage with Brother Lane Rittmeyer, and he sort of concurred that it could actually have that meaning, that the just construction of the Hebrew can mean that it was talking about two different periods of 20 years, and it may therefore be that this is the model where the 20 years that he speaks of here in verse 41, which is outlined as being 14 years and 6, was this 14 years and this 6 years, but not consecutive. And the other 20 years, which it says in verse 38, says, this 20 years have I been with thee. He's not serving as such. He's actually there in his house at the time. So the two periods being 20 years of service for paying off the dowry and for cattle and so on, and 20 years where he was just with him in the house as a friend and a relative and working on the farm, with the cattle and so on that were there. Now, what that actually means is that there could well have been, and my own preference looking at the whole of this situation is that it probably was a 40-year period. I know others will possibly disagree with that. But be that as it may, it's not a, as I said, not a real point of contention or of dogmatism. It's really just there for interest. So whether it was 20 or 40, the principle of him being in Syria doesn't alter as a result of that. So, but there's one thing that we do notice straight away as soon as we start reading this period, which covers a number of chapters here in Genesis, interestingly, chapter 29, 30, 31, which are long chapters as well through this period. And you think, well, there's an awful lot of detail given to us about this little period. But there's a couple of significant observations that are worth making right from the outset. And the first one is the constant mention of shepherding. Shepherding is a theme that goes right through here. Jacob's experience when he was in Syria was largely connected to shepherding. And we'll come back to that in just a second. And the other thing is that nearly everything that happened to Jacob that's mentioned in chapters 29, 30, and 31 when he was actually there in the house of Laban is all to do with the close family relationships that were going on there. And remember this, that God is guiding him, is taking him over there for a purpose. And he said, when I've finished with you, whatever I'm going to achieve, I will bring you back to the land. So God's work with him had to do with two major things. The experiences of Jacob were about shepherds and shepherding, and they were also about family relationships. And you know, brothers and sisters, those two things are so significant in our lives and the way God actually shapes every one of us, though it might be different for every one of us. The focus of Jacob's probation was around shepherding and families. Now, how many men can you think of in the Bible who were raised up to do great works that before they got to be to doing the great work that God actually had for them set down, were shepherds? You know, the giants, I'm talking about the real giants in the scripture. You start thinking about them. Who was there? Moses? Abraham? David? I mean, we're talking about monumental characters that turned the nation's history. And what did God do with them? He sent them out there to keep sheep. And now we find Jacob out there keeping sheep. What is that saying? Because you and I are not going to go and keep sheep. Maybe unless you're a Knowles. And you might have sheep running around your backyard. But what is that actually saying? What is this principle of shepherding, brothers and sisters? Well, in a modern parallel, I think it's probably very closely akin to our ecclesial life. And God will put us into a circumstance where there is a need for us to take responsibility for shepherding. And it doesn't mean to say that everyone's going to be an arranging brother. That's every single person in an ecclesia has a responsibility for shepherding. And God puts us in ecclesias to learn patience and to change us by shepherding. You know, it's very difficult, brothers and sisters, in ecclesial life at times, as we all know. It can be very comforting. It can be a place of great consolation. But sometimes there is the frost by night and the sun by day, and it's not very pleasant. And God deliberately puts us in the circumstances where he can shape our characters. Character will not ever be formed in just a plain, smooth sailing situation where there's just affluence on every side, where everything just goes so stunningly well. God can't shape us in those circumstances. But he can in a shepherding environment where we have got to take on the responsibility and we are forced to face situations. But the other thing, without any question, that's in this is that the vast majority of Jacob's shaping and testing happened within his own family context. It was right inside his house. And you and I know, brethren and sisters, all of us know that families are very powerful shapers. They're very powerful shapers because it's there that we get the rough edges rubbed off and that fuses fly and all kinds of things tend to happen there because of our very close and protected relationships with individuals. So here God used those same circumstances in Jacob's life. Well, he comes to Syria. And what do we find? Verse 2 of chapter 29. And he looked as soon as he arrived, and behold, a well in the field. Well, what's so strange about a well in the field? And lo, there were three flocks of sheep lying by it. For out of that well they watered the flocks, and a great stone was upon the well's mouth. What's this amazement of Jacob when he gets there? He sees all these flocks around the well, and you know, it was normal to water sheep in the morning and in the evening and take them out to pasture during the day, but here in the middle of the day, all the sheep are just all cluttered around the well. Verse 7, and he said, lo, it's yet high day, neither is it time that the cattle should be gathered together. Water ye the sheep and go and feed them. Get them out. What are you doing? And they said, oh, we cannot until all the flocks be gathered together, until they roll the stone from the well's mouth. Then we water the sheep. So they brought in their flocks and, you know, oh, it was all too hard. This is Syrian. This is Syria here. This isn't where the patriarchs came from, who knew how to shepherd and who'd grown up in that environment. It's all just too hard. Oh, they only want to move the stone once. I mean, why would we want to, you know, put too much effort into this thing? Because we'll wait till they all get here and then we'll all lift this stone. You know, Jacob got that stone and pulled it off himself. So he was stunned by what he saw. He saw already, the moment he arrived, the laziness of the Syrian characteristic. They had no skill in shepherding. And Laban was just the epitome of that. You know, when he arrived, chapter 30, verse 30 tells us that Laban had a very small flock and his daughters looked after him. That's how much he had. That was by great contrast because Jacob came in, worked very hard, and Laban's flocks increased immensely as a result of Jacob's determined hard work and his role in shepherding. You know, it's always a characteristic that we find in the patriarchs who are noted for commitment and diligence, not laziness as these Syrians were. The Syrian characteristic being one of the flesh is just never wanting to pursue something that's worth doing, that's got value and character and purpose to it. But, you know, Jacob and Isaac, his father, remember, Isaac goes out and digs these wells, and men of purpose, and Jacob really had the same, essentially the same characteristics. What's this, the introduction we have to Laban's house here in verse 9? And while he yet spake with them, these shepherds, he doesn't know where he is at this stage, Rachel came with her father's sheep, for she kept them. So Rachel is the first person from the land, apart from seeing some shepherds and stuff around. She's the first person he meets. And it came to pass, verse 10, when Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, and the sheep of Laban, his mother's brother, that Jacob went near and rolled the stone from the well's mouth and watered the flock of Laban, his mother's brother. Whoa, are we not being told something here, brothers and sisters? Did we need it so labored that this was his mother's brother? That this was really the reason for him going back? And this theme started back, you remember, earlier when we found the record emphasizing the connection with Assyrian and his mother's connection with Assyrian. Now we're told that these sheep belong to his mother's brother and the flock there is Laban's, his mother's brother, and so on. And it just doesn't stop there. It keeps on going down here through the record. So we do notice, however, that Jacob first is impressed by Rachel's beauty, and that, in fact, actually became a problem. The second thing that we really notice here is that this emphasis on Laban, his mother's brother, because this was the Syrian that Jacob was to really come head-to-head with and understand and see Syrian characteristics, the characteristics of the flesh, for what they really are. He couldn't see it in himself and he couldn't see it in his mother, but when he came face to face with this relative, he actually came to understand the seriousness of the problem that he faced and you and I face as well. Well, in verse 11, it says, Jacob kissed Rachel and lifted up his voice and wept. You know, I think the kissing of Rachel here is not just because he loved her at first sight. It's because of a deep sense of thankfulness and of joy because the angels had guided his way. The very last thing we read is that Jacob lifted up his feet and in no time he was over there, because what was buoying him along was the confidence and assurance that God had just given him, that the angels were going to be with him all the way. And the angels had guided him right to the very house that he needed to go. And so when he finds out that this is his Laban, his mother's brother's house, and it's the first place that he comes to in Syria, no wonder he weeps with joy here, because of the guidance that the angels had given him. But this was not to be the last of tears from Jacob, and they were to come with anguish and bitterness as time rolled on, as God prepared him for the kingdom. Verse 13, and it came to pass when Laban heard the tidings of Jacob, his sister's son, that he ran to meet him, embraced him and kissed him and brought him to the house, and he told Laban all these things. And Laban said unto him, surely thou art bone of my flesh, my bone and my flesh, and he abode with him the space of a month. So Laban runs to meet Jacob here and embraces him and welcomes him as bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. You're part of our family. And it was quite ironical that in many ways Jacob was like his uncle Laban, very much like him when he came. But after the experience in his house, he left very, very different from this man. And you know, it says here, when Laban heard all that Jacob was saying, you know, what, you wonder what Jacob told him. Why was he there? I don't think there's any doubt that Laban was motivated for the wrong reasons here. You remember that Laban was involved when his own sister Rebekah was taken back into the promised land to be a wife for Isaac. And at that stage, Laban's eyes lit up with dollar signs because he had heard at that point and saw all the jewels dripping out of the cases of Abraham's servant. And he found out that this man Abraham, this relative in a distant country, was absolutely fabulously rich. And so he was wanting to curry favor. And of course he wanted his sister to get married. And he himself takes over and controls all the wedding arrangements, the arrangements with the wife, for her to go back. So he knew from that past experience that he was the heir of Abraham's fortune, walking into his house again. Oh, he wasn't going to let him go in too easily. So what was Laban really like? Well, we know this when we put the record in. And we're not going to look at all these passages tonight. You just really haven't got time. But in summary, what the record paints Laban as is a man that was motivated by love of money and by selfishness. He runs. In fact, we hardly ever find him running. But the only time we find him running is when there's money involved. So he runs when gold's involved, and he accepted the dowry for his sister. He's interested in Abraham's wealth. But not only that, he's a lazy man. He's called in chapter 29, verse 5, the son of Nahor, which means a snorer, and that's significant in its own right. He manipulates others to serve him and does very little himself. He's even got his own daughters out there looking after the sheep. He's deceitful and scheming. And the issue of Jacob's wives and the cattle deals that followed and changing of the wages. And he was a taskmaster of terrible proportions who had no integrity, demanded exact retribution for losses. Jacob said that at the end of his time. You know, it doesn't matter whether a wild beast came in and took one of the sheep, he had to pay for it. Laban would demand that he paid for it. And even though he was out there night and day and had no protection, still Jacob had to pay for it. And he constantly changed his wages. So he was a terrible man that into this very house, he is now the prince of God, the heir to the Abrahamic fortune, is now come that he might serve this poor man. Because Laban was not a rich man. He was, you know, it's very interesting, isn't it, when you stop and just think about what could have happened in these circumstances. Because given the wealth that the house of Abraham and Isaac actually had back in the land, it could easily have happened that Jacob could have said, right, I've found the one I want to marry. I'll arrange for a dowry to be brought. Go back, send over some fabulous present, take his wife back, or send a servant over to get her with the present and go back. But that's not what happened. You know, Hosea says, Jacob fled into the country of Syria, and there Israel served for a wife. Why did he need to serve for a wife? There was more than enough money back there to pay for a dowry. So there's other reasons. It's not that it couldn't have been different. It could have. But the difference was that God was in control here. And God was creating a prince to be with him by allowing him to serve in that house. And so Laban was to play Jacob's own game until he learned to hate those Syrian ways. You know, brothers and sisters, in our lives, and most of you that have lived a few will certainly probably realise the truth of this, that, you know, sometimes there are circumstances in our lives that we think in principle we've learnt the lesson that God's trying to teach us, only to find that the whole situation comes back in our face again. And God will continue to raise things back in our lives at times until we do really face those issues. And sometimes we only think we do, and we deceive ourselves. But he will persist because he loves us, as he loved Jacob, until we really learn to forsake our trust in self and put our trust in him. Well, this man was so scheming and deceitful, as we know, that he exploited Jacob's love for Rachel and performed this incredibly cruel trick. You know, in essence, if you sort of do a bit of a monetary calculation, if Jacob served for 7 years and then another 7 years, he paid dearly for those wives. On 14 years' wages, by today's standards, it'd be $500,000. It would have been a lot easier to have taken something from the family fortune. And yet, come down to chapter 29 and verse 25, when we find that finally this deception is lands back on his own head, and he finds that he's been deceived. Verse 25, and it came to pass that in the morning, behold, it was Leah. And he said to Laban, what hast thou done unto me? Did I not serve with thee for Rachel? Wherefore then hast thou beguiled me? Yeah, indeed. This is an exact rerun of what he'd done to his father, isn't it? Jacob had met his match now. And what could he do in these circumstances? Well, look what Laban comes back with in verse 26. Laban said, it must not be so done in our country to give the younger before the firstborn. Where did Laban get that from? What we're told in the record is that when Jacob first came to Laban, he sat down and he told them all about what had been going on. And presumably, he told him that he was the younger, the circumstance of the blessing, and how God had said the elder shall serve the younger. And now Laban puts in the knife, not in our country. Your God might be different, but you're here in Syria now, and we don't work like that. So the elder serving the younger is not part of our culture. And so Jacob was left with nothing. What did he call? What could he do? He said, fulfill her week, verse 27, and we will give thee this also for the service which thou shalt serve with me yet another 7 years. And Jacob did so and fulfilled her week. Jacob did so. Look how simple that is. Jacob did so. Another 7 years, just in that little phrase. And Jacob did so. Jacob just had to learn to suffer wrong, to suffer deception and injustice, and to take it patiently. That's why God had taken him there, brothers and sisters. It's why God takes us down the road he does. It's not very pleasant, is it? And that wasn't pleasant. But it's the very set of circumstances that will help us to transform from being self-reliant to being God-dependent. And that's where God was taking him. And I'm not finished with you, Jacob, God said, and I'll never leave you until I've finished that I've promised. And here Jacob was to have to face injustice and wrong, and take it patiently. You know, brothers and sisters, when the Apostle Peter picked up that little phrase and coined the phrase that we should follow his steps, that is, Jesus' steps, the very context of those words are suffering injustice, taking it patiently. Because he himself, when he was abused, didn't revile. When he was threatened, he didn't threaten back. He just accepted injustice and took it without saying a word. That's the context of following his steps, brothers and sisters. And you know what? God will take us down the same path. He takes every son whom he and daughter whom he has down that path. Because until we are prepared to accept things that are unjust in this world's terms, unjust as far as human reasoning is concerned, then we actually have not come to fellowship the sufferings of Christ, nor have we appreciated what God is trying to do with us. Because he's trying to break our self-reliance. He's trying to break our spirit that says, but he, I, this, me, why? And only by taking us in that to those circumstances can God actually do that. And we've got to learn. And here we find Jacob, 7 years in, finding that he's met his match and he can't do anything else. And he must have gone and laid down on his bed at night and cried bitter tears. And yet come to realize and to remember that great vision of Bethel. God said, I'll never leave you, Jacob. I'm always here. I'm in control. Do you know what? If Jacob had remembered that instead of being infatuated with Rachel at the time, on the morning he woke up and found that he had the wrong wife, what Jacob should have done was to say, God promised that he would always guide. This is the wife he wants me to have. Packed his bags and left because he'd already paid for her. He'd already paid the 7 years. But he didn't. He said, but it's not fair. You can't do this. How come you've done this to me? And Laban said, if you want her, another 7. And he said, yeah, I want her. So the decision he made that day brought untold misery and anguish into his house. But the angel had actually already clearly pointed out what was best, and he took another path. Now we know that the purpose of God wouldn't have been the same, and the history of the nation wouldn't have been the same. And God knew what was going to happen. And God was still able to work with that choice, bad as it was. And so he will with us, because he's determined that if we are motivated by faith despite our weakness, despite the circumstances and the pressures that come upon us to make decisions that are wrong sometimes, he will still work and bring us to his desired end. Well, even Laban's daughters couldn't stand their father's avarice and greed and their attitude in the end, and even they felt there was no integrity in what he was doing. And they wanted to get out of that. And he was a typical example of a man of the flesh that's painted in this record that Jacob has to come up against, that was pierced through with many sorrows because the love of money was at the root of all kinds of evil. And that evil dispensed itself out onto all those around. Well, Laban was a Syrian to the core, a man of the flesh of which he became a type, a great deceiver and hypocrite who spoke spiritual words to try and achieve his own ends. You know, we find him talking about Yahweh and mouthing the words of the truth at times, and yet in this man, Jacob came to see all that he never, never wanted to be. And he learned a profound lesson. And that's the lesson that unless we face injustice brought about by men like that, unless suffering comes into our lives and tests our allegiance to God or our allegiance to self, then God can have no work for us in the future. Well, what about Rachel? This was another Syrian in Jacob's life that He took much longer to see through than Laban. She was truly a daughter of her father. Come to chapter 29 and verse 16. And Laban had two daughters. The name of the elder was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. And Leah was tender-eyed, but Rachel was beautiful and well-favored. So as she's introduced to us here, as Rotherham translates that last phrase, she was comely in form and comely in appearance. She was evidently a very beautiful young girl. And Jacob was transfixed by her, and his reason went out of the window. It's not to say that he was not a godly and faithful man, or that he was not a man of integrity, but he actually made a similar mistake to that which Isaac had made with Esau in judging by the senses rather than by what is seen by faith. And it appears the way the record is written, brothers and sisters, that Jacob's attraction for Rachel was physical and not spiritual. Because there's not one occasion in the record where Jacob and Rachel are united on the issues of the truth. There's not one time when we see them together in the record. It's not to say that there weren't times when they did see. And I'm not trying to paint Rachel in as the black sheep of the family, because the record is not written the way it is for us to make decisions about people's character. But it is written in a way that it brings out and highlights certain characteristics and certain lessons and also certain types. But it's unquestioned that she impeded him spiritually and wore him down. And he made decisions based on his love for her, which at times were a little irrational. But we are told that she really was a daughter of her father. Let's have a look at verse 1 of chapter 30. And when Rachel saw, this is after Leah has had a number of children, Rachel saw that she bare Jacob no children. Rachel envied her sister and said unto Jacob, "Give me children, else I die." Now, it was a very frustrating circumstance that she was in, but essentially here's the voice of the Syrian crying out, demanding, and it's in his own house now, and Jacob reacts. He knew that children were from God. He knew that barrenness had been in the family, and he knew the reason for all of that. Verse 2, and Jacob's anger was kindled against Rachel, and he said, "Am I in God's stead who hath withheld from thee the fruit of the womb?" What could he do about this, brothers and sisters? Here he is in a situation where he understands that God was in control of all of that, and he understood that God was in control of his whole life. And yet now he's confronted with this, and so she resorts to scheming. And verse 3, and she said, "Behold, my maid Bilhah, going unto her, and she shall bear children upon my knees, that I may also have children by her." And ignoring the lessons of Sarah's experience in the past, we find that, look what she says in verse 6, and Rachel said, "God hath judged me, and hath also heard my voice, and hath given me a son." And she called his name Dan. And then when, in verse 8, Rachel said, when the next son came, "With great wrestlings I have wrestled with my sister, and I have prevailed." And she called his name Naphtali. And she tries mandrakes, a fertility drug, and superstition. And she denies access from Leah to Jacob, and sells her husband for a night, and so on. All of this goes on. And not until some considerable time after does she finally, the record tells us, begin to acknowledge that God is in control of this and praise. And to her credit, she does realize that in the end. Verse 22, and God remembered Rachel, and God hearkened to her, and opened her womb, and she conceived and bare a son. So, we find that there was this characteristic in her that She did come to understand and to learn that lesson. But we find a little later when they try to leave the house of Laban, that Rachel steals the teraphim that were belonging to her father. And these were those small images that were used as in the families as the symbol of the inheritance. And so here she's stealing her father's inheritance, so to speak, not remembering that she has a greater and more enduring promise that was entrusted to her husband and to all those before. And yet she even deceived her father, Laban, that she didn't have them. And Jacob at the time, you remember, he was very angry at Laban for pursuing him and going through all his stuff and not finding anything. And he said, let him die. Let him not live that has these things. And it was only months after that that Rachel passed away before they came to Bethlehem. You know, it's a very sad story, but Rachel in the record is painted as a type of Israel after the flesh. And Leah is painted, in contrast, in the record, as Israel after the spirit. And it's not to say that Rachel was not a faithful woman in her latter days and did not actually understand and was not motivated by faith. She was living in a very, very difficult circumstance, as they all were in the midst of that house. And we do know that Joseph had a vision in which he saw the sun, moon and stars bowing down at a future time, representing his father and mother and his brothers. So it may well be, brethren and sisters, that Rachel is in the kingdom. So it's not for us to judge her by the record, but it's painted like that to highlight the type of Israel after the flesh. But what about Leah? She's painted differently. In chapter 29, verse 17, she's said to be tender-eyed, which really just means soft and pliable. And clearly, Jacob did not have a spiritual relationship, with Rachel, because he hadn't even realized until the morning that he'd had the wrong bride, and it was a startling realization at that stage. But we do find that here Leah was termed tender-eyed. She's not said to be stunningly beautiful in appearance and in her poise, but she is said to have tender eyes, pliable, soft, tender eyes. The eyes being the window to the soul, the window to the mind. And here it's talking of openness and sincerity. And she's someone that God could and did work with. And God cared for her. Chapter 29 and verse 31 tells us that. 29:31. And when Yahweh saw that Leah was hated, he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. And she craved Jacob's attention all her days because she loved him and learned to love what he treasured. She learned to love the promises. And in recognition of that and of the providence of God in their lives, she named five of her sons with the name of God or something to do with the promises. And she never turned vindictive, which would have been a very difficult time for her. And in the end, from her came the priesthood through Levi and the kingship through Judah and eventually the line to Christ. But perhaps one of the greatest testimonies to Leah is actually right at the end of Genesis, because in Genesis 49 and at verse 31, Jacob at the end of his life says, there they buried, talking about the field of Ephron, there they buried Abraham and Sarah his wife. There they buried Isaac and Rebekah, his wife. And there I buried Leah. And he asked his children to take him back, and they buried him there too. So there was Abraham and Sarah, Isaac and Rebekah, Jacob and Leah, all enfolded in that tomb in the field of Ephron. Because In the end, she was recognized as the type of the true mother in Israel, the true wife of Jacob, whom God had originally intended for his good all his days. And she was the one who represented Israel after the Spirit, all of us who would be enfolded together with the faithful. Well, so much for the characters of those individuals there, brethren and sisters. And while there is a lot of detail in the record here about some of the experiences that happened during that period, we're going to jump right across most of that and come to the end, to the point when Jacob decides that he must leave. You know, brethren and sisters, after a time, Jacob knew that he didn't belong in Syria. In fact, he came to despise the character of Laban. He knew God had promised to bring him back into the land. Look, come to chapter 30 and verse 25, because here we find it came to pass when Rachel had borne Joseph that Jacob said unto Laban, send me away that I may go into mine own place and to my country. Notice that. To my own place and my country. Now, he knew that it wasn't his yet, but he's calling it his because he knew it had been promised to Abraham and to Isaac, and now that promise had come to him. This was not his country. He didn't want to live in Syria. He didn't want what the flesh represented. And here, Laban, who represents the flesh in its worst form here, doesn't give up quite as easily. The flesh has a powerful grip, and here Laban comes back to him in verse 27 and said unto him, oh, I pray you, if I've found favor in your eyes, tarry, for I've learned by experience that Yahweh hath blessed me for your sake. And he said, appoint me thy wages and I'll give you. Just anything, Jacob. Oh, please stay. Just say how much you want and I'll be happy to give you anything if you'll stay on with me. And appears on the surface to be incredibly conciliatory and generous offer. But Jacob, knowing this man through and through, knowing the flesh, brethren and sisters, as he'd come to understand the flesh and Syrian ways by this time, would have nothing from him. He would take nothing from that man. He offers at that point to work for cattle. He would not take a single beast from him. And he said, I'll take the spotted, the speckled, the brown. And Laban couldn't believe his ears. They were the worst part of the flock. They were not the thoroughbreds. They were the worst part of the flock. And now he's saying he's going to work in order to get the spotted, speckled and brown out of the flock. And Laban sort of runs home and with his rubbing his hands together because he's never heard of such things. If he wants to have that, let him have it. I mean, he's his family. His daughters are in his house. He's got all these grandchildren. And Laban is so stingy that he's wanting to only let him have that, won't give him anything. And when he hears Jacob says, well, I won't take anything, I'll just work a little longer for these things, he says, you beauty, now I've got him. What he then does is he takes all his breeding stock, 3 days' journey, 72 hours down the track, so that not one single one of those cattle can possibly come in contact with any of those, so there can be no spotted, no ring-straked, no brown born. That's what he was dealing with. That's Laban. That's the flesh, brothers and sisters. Sounds very plausible. But in the end, it has not one ounce of interest in us eternally. We owe it nothing, brethren and sisters. Just like Jacob came to realize, he owed Laban nothing. He would take nothing from him because he was not interested in his eternal well-being. And you know what? Jacob accepted that in patience. He could see what he's up to. He saw him pack up his things in the middle of the night and charge off. And he knew where they went. He knew exactly what he was thinking. And he saw that injustice and all that evil. And over the next 6 years, he changed his wages 10 times. You know what that means? 10 times is used in Scripture to mean continuously. Just constantly kept changing. So what had happened? Jacob would say, I'll have all the spotted. I don't mind. I'll just have the spotted of the flock. And the spotted get born. So Laban comes back and says, No. Could we change the arrangements? What about if you take the speckled now? So Jacob says, okay. Then speckled get born. And Laban changes it again, and changes it again, and changes it again. What does Jacob do? What could he do? He just accepts it. In fact, what he does do, and there's a very strange story in the record there about the rods, seems to be very superstitious. He had these peeled rods, which were an attempt to try and increase his proportion of the herd. Knowing the laws of genetics, there's no reason why anything like that would have actually worked. But we see evidence of Jacob's thinking a little later. But, you know, when Jacob's flocks increased, you have a look at verse 31 and verse 1. And he heard the words of Laban's son saying, Jacob hath taken away all that was our father's, and of all that which was our father's hath he gotten all his glory. And Jacob beheld the countenance of Laban, and behold, it was not towards him as before. Now, it was nothing that he'd done. This was more false accusation. More family tension that's building up here. And verse 3 tells us, and Yahweh said unto Jacob, this is the first time Yahweh had appeared to him in 40 years or thereabouts. Yahweh said unto Jacob, Jacob, return unto the land of thy fathers and to thy kindred, and I will be with thee. What did that make him remember? The time he laid his head on that stone and heard those words with the heavenly messenger. That I'm not going to leave you until I'm finished. And I'll bring you back. And now the angel comes. Jacob, the time's up. Whatever was being achieved has been achieved. I'm still going to be with you. And I'm going to take you back. You know, it's a confirmation of that promise at Bethel. It must have really made his heart leap with excitement, because now here, after all that time of no visible hand of God in his life there, only looking for signs and seeing blank walls and great gaping holes set for traps for him by Laban. You know, it seems that he'd been praying that he might be able to get out of there. And he'd waited and waited and waited. And God was giving him more and more cattle. And he waited. And 6 years, 6 long years, and they were long years in Laban's house, went on. And verse 4, and Jacob sent and called Rachel and Leah to the field unto his flock. He called them out there, brethren and sisters, because he couldn't even talk anywhere near his house. He couldn't even talk anywhere near where his father-in-law would see. And he said, I see your father's countenance that is not towards me as before, but the God of my father hath been with me. And ye know that with all my power I have served your father. And your father hath deceived me and changed my wages 10 times. But God suffered him not to hurt me. If he said thus, the speckled should be thy wages, then all the cattle bear speckled. And if he said, thus the ring straight to be the height, then they all bear ring straight. Thus God hath taken away the cattle of your father and give them to me. Wasn't anything he'd done. Now Jacob is completely trusting in God, and God is actually working. God is doing all this stuff, and Jacob now sees the providential hand. He's not looking to scheme anymore. He's actually seeing what God is really doing. And he's telling his wives here that God's been with us the whole time, and it's now time that we're going to leave there. Here's a man, brothers and sisters, who's learning to trust God and to let go of trusting in his own scheming, because he'd come up head to head with this man that he realized was just an epitome of all that the flesh really is. You know, and though he had done what he could in the circumstances, and whatever he used those rods for, and had some scheme, you know, God reveals to him exactly what was going on. Verse 10, and it came to pass at the time the cattle conceived that I lifted up mine eyes and saw in a dream, and behold, the rams which leaped upon the cattle were ring-straight, speckled, and grizzled. And the angel of God spake unto me a dream, saying, Jacob. And I said, Here I am. And he said, Lift up now thine eyes and see all the rams which leap upon the cattle, are ringstraked, speckled, and grizzled. For I have seen all that Laban doeth unto thee. You know what that vision was all about, brothers and sisters? God was telling him in a dream that night, Laban, Jacob, I've suffered, Laban, for many years. But now the work has come to an end, and I can see your plight, and I'm sympathetic to it. And it wasn't anything that you did that caused the cattle to be born. It was me. Jacob, as I said before, the heavenly messenger told him, I'm able to do things that you can't. Laban had separated that flock 72 hours down the road so that none of those rams could get to any of these ewes. But Jacob, understand that I brought them back. You couldn't do that. Laban didn't understand that. And in a dream, he was told, so that he could understand, that what seems impossible to men is possible with God. And there's the core issue of Jacob's life. He's coming finally to learn that what it was impossible for him to do, God was able to do. It's a lesson that he was slow to learn, but it's a lesson, brethren and sisters, that every one of us are probably even slower than Jacob to learn. Verse 13, I am the God, the power of Bethel, where thou anointest the pillar and where thou vowest a vow unto me. Arise now and go. What an incredible inspiration that must have been to him. You know, that's the only time in the scripture where we find the term the God of Bethel. The God of Bethel. What does that conjure in your mind in the life of Jacob, brothers? Is the God of Bethel. We know what happened at Bethel. We know what that God was like. That was the God that he went to find. He went up through those mountains, stumbling across the rocks, up and down those hills, trying to find that altar so that he could find the God of Bethel that Abraham had found. And now he found him. And that very same God comes back and he says, Jacob, I'm the God of Bethel. Remember your reaction, how you anointed that pillar and you vowed. Remember how you felt. I'm the God that made you feel like that. It's time to go. So he re-raised in his mind the desire and the commitment that he had at that time when he left Bethel and his feet skipped across the mountains and soon came to Syria. And now he tells him to leave, because the exercise of faith has worked its course. So Jacob prepares to steal away, because he knew that he couldn't get away if he just went and told Laban. He wouldn't be able to get away from the flesh. He couldn't just extricate himself from that. So he had to steal away. He made a determination, and we know what happens. The flesh pursued him. Laban came after him. But the angel of God stepped in and stopped Laban. The angels that are on the staircase came down into Laban's path and said, Laban, don't touch him. When you catch up with him, be careful what you do to him. There's an exchange that happens between Jacob and Laban, verse 36 of chapter 31. Chapter 31, 36. A very passionate exchange here. And Jacob was wroth when finally Laban has gone through all his stuff and can't find anything. And Jacob answered and said to Laban, what is my trespass? And what is my sin that thou so hotly pursued after me? You've gone through everything I've got. You've pulled it all apart and you've found nothing. You've chased me halfway across the country because I'm leaving. What's it all about? Verse 38. This 20 years have I been with you. Thy ewes and thy she-goats have not cast their young, and the rams of thy flock have I not eaten. That which was torn of the beasts I brought not unto thee. I bear the loss of it. Of my hand didst thou require, whether stolen by day or stolen by night. Thus I was,
In the day the drought consumed me, and the frost by night, and my sleep departed from mine eyes. Thus have I been 20 years in your house. I served thee 14 years for thy two daughters, 6 years for thy cattle, and thou hast changed my wages 10 times. Except the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac had been with me, surely thou hadst sent me now away empty. God hath seen my affliction and the labor of my hands, and rebuked thee yesternight. And now, as the passion rose in him, he wanted nothing of Syria. He wanted nothing of Laban. Hated everything it stood for. He couldn't see it when he first went there. Now he hates it. He realized that the God of Abraham was the only one he could trust. And he made a covenant of separation with Laban. Laban made a covenant with him. Excuse me. Laban made a covenant with him so that he would protect his inheritance, so that Jacob would never come back and try and take anything from him again. As if Jacob had taken anything from him. Such was Laban. But Jacob was glad to have a covenant of separation between the flesh, between the Syrian and those who were going to live by faith. And so verse 55 of chapter 31 says, "And early in the morning Laban rose up and kissed his sons and his daughters and blessed them. And Laban departed and returned unto his place. And Jacob," verse 1 of 32, "went on his way." So one goes back to his place and Jacob goes on his way. "And the angels of God met him." That is absolutely amazing, brethren and sisters. Jacob turns his back finally, makes a cut with Syria, and sets his heart to go back to the promised land. And immediately the angels meet him in the way. You know, that's the first time in Scripture that the host of the angels of heaven appeared to any man. Now, Jacob had seen in a vision the host of angels. Now, after God had dealt with him, and he's turned his back and he's finally learnt the lesson that God wanted him to learn. The assurance was that I'll never leave you. The angels of God come in force to him. "See, I'm with you." Amazing, isn't it? That God works in such ways. It tells us something about our God, brethren and sisters. It tells us about his passion for those whom he loves and he wants to work with and bring to his kingdom. Because here, God couldn't restrain himself and said to his angels, "Go and give him assurance. Show him that you're still there." And so he will in our lives, not necessarily by angels, but by the circumstances. Because God is deeply interested in the lives of all those he calls. Not because we're of any worth, but because of what we can become. And just as God never lost interest in Jacob, nor will he in us, if our driving passion is by faith. If a man of Jacob's caliber, with his remarkable wealth of spiritual experience, was slow to recognize the hand of God in his life, is it to be wondered at that others of a smaller stature, living in a more materialistic world, so often fail to realize the existence of the same essential factors in their lives? Read our lives. The faith which honors God and which God honors is that which looks not at things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. The very fact that the set of one's own human nature and of the hard materialistic environment one is called to live in is against the exercise of faith should teach all the Israel of God the need for a deliberate emphasis in outlook on divine providence. Faith is the key virtue, and without it,
it is impossible to please God.